So we're beginning the Ntivot Shalom. The Ntivot Shalom was the Rebbe of Slonim. When you guys see those Hasidim with blue and white, those are their Baralach. Those are Yerushalmi Hasidim. There were also Slonim Hasidim. There are still Slonim Hasidim in Mea Shearim. And the Rebbe of Slonim just passed away a few years ago. We have MP3 recordings of some of the classes he gave. His Hasidut is considered probably the most accessible. If you want to learn a little bit of Hasidut. So, in our parasha it says, Vayishlach Hashem b'amta nechashim. So, Hashem sent serpents against the nation. So the Torah describes, Vayisum ho'ra'al derech yamsuf. They traveled from the mountain where Aaron passed away in the direction of Yamsuf. Vatikzal nefsham b'darech. So the nation got tired along the road. Vayidaber ha'am b'elokim u'moshe. So the nation started speaking out against God, against Moshe. Lama elitunu mimitzrayim? What you take us out of Egypt for lamut b'midbar, to die in this desert? Kein lechem ve'en mayim v'nafshenu katsa b'lechem haklokel. There's no bread, there's no water, and we're sick and tired of this man. Vayishlach Hashem b'amta nechashim asrafim. So God sent serpents against the nation. Vayinashchu ta'am. They bit the nation. That's the story we have in our parasha. Parasha zo ktuva achar parashat mitat Aaron b'orahar. We read this, the Torah recounts this, directly following Aaron's passing in the mountain that was a double mountain. So we have to explain why are these two adjacent. And really we have to clarify the whole idea of what's going on anyways. Why were they punished with such a severe punishment that these serpents came and bit them? We don't find any other time that they got a punishment like that. They had other sins in the desert. Never did Hashem just send wild dogs to bite them or serpents or something like that. Ordinarily, we assume that Hashem's punishment fits the crime. Why is this sin so severe? So they said, we're sick and tired of this bread. No. Why is that so severe that they deserved such a punishment? We also have to understand what it says later on. After they're being bitten and people are dropping like flies, they come to Moshe and they say, we've sinned, we apologize, we've spoken properly about you and God, about God and you. Pray to Hashem, he should remove the snake from us. Moshe prays on behalf of the nation. So God tells Moshe, make a copper serpent, put it up on a banner, and if anyone gets bitten by the snake, he'd only look up at that copper serpent and live. Any other time we find in the desert that Israel sinned, any other time Moshe davens, Hashem says fine and the punishment stops. That's not what happened here. Here, they suddenly needed to look at the snake in order to get healed, and the snake was still biting them. You see, they needed a cure. It wasn't that Hashem said, okay, no more snake, no more biting. Moshe prays on their behalf, and what does Hashem say? Okay, make yourself a copper serpent. Here, they needed this copper serpent. And if someone got bitten, he'd have to look at that. If he didn't look up to that copper serpent, he dropped dead after getting bitten, as Rashi recounts, and as our sages say. The Mishnah says in Rosh Hashanah, "Bizman shisayim mistaklin klapei mala." If the Jewish people look up and subdue their hearts to their Father in heaven, they'd get healed. And if not, the Mishnah says, people will die. So a person would get bitten, and he'd have to decide, am I looking up or not? If he looks up, he lives. If he doesn't, he dies. So we have to understand, why is this different than all the other sins in the desert that in other times they did tshuva and they prayed. After they repented, Hashem took away the punishment. And here, even though they said we sinned and they asked Hashem for forgiveness, they still needed this copper snake. So we could explain the idea that the great sin over here was that their approach was, God, we don't like the way you're running the show. It was different than other times. What was their claim? They said, what'd you take us out of Egypt for? What'd you take us through a desert for? There's no bread, there's no water, and we're sick and tired of the food you're giving us. It wasn't that they were saying, we're hungry. It wasn't that they were coming and saying, there's no food to eat, there's nothing to drink. They had what to eat. They had holy food. They had what to drink. They had holy water. They had water that was miraculous water. But what were they saying? They were saying there's no bread or water. They're saying we're not happy with the bread and water you're giving us. We don't like your service, God. You know, I come to a restaurant, I had a funny experience this week. I'm just telling you because you might want to do this before you make the order, which I learned the hard way. I made an order, and then I asked to use the facilities. I come out of the facilities, I see there's no soap by the water, by the sink. So I asked the staff, is it possible to get me soap from the kitchen? They said, we don't have soap in the kitchen. I said, keep your food. I'm not, you know, I'll pay you for the order, but I'm not touching it. So I learned something this week. No soap in the kitchen, okay? That I don't know if I'm allowed to say. I have to tell you, it's not the first time it happened to me.
They don't wash their hands before they
that is, the guy tells me, what do you want? I wash my hands with water. Okay? I'm just telling you because I learned something this week. Oh. I'd rather, if I would have known it beforehand, I wouldn't have made an order.
I want to let you guys know that the hotel, no one uses any soap either when they go down the dock.
Not no one, because you have a lot of people who have children with them, and then they have fresh wipes. Here in Yeshiva, there was a time when there wasn't too much soap in the dishes either. So I used to have a pack of fresh wipes here. That way I could have soap with me. So when I go with my kids, you have fresh wipes, you wash your hands, you can have soap that way. So at any rate, the people were looking at God and saying, we're not pleased with your service. We don't like the food you're offering. We don't like what's on the menu. And in essence, they were looking at God and saying, we don't like the way you run the world. And our sages said, where do you find a wealthy person? That's a person who could be happy with his lot. And I gave a whole class on this in the beginning of the week in Kochav Yaakov. Kids will do this to you. They'll say, Dad, I want an ISIS. And you'll say, no, we're not eating ISIS now. And the kid will say, I'm not happy because you didn't give me an ISIS. I'm upset. So what's a parent supposed to answer? So what I tell my kids is, you're upset? Okay. You'll continue being upset because you've decided to be upset because you didn't get an ISIS and you're still not going to get an ISIS. So it's your choice.
I understand how you feel. I understand
your. Oh, sometimes, yeah, but sometimes it's totally illegitimate. He wakes up in the morning and decides, I don't want breakfast. I want ISIS. Good for you. You're not getting ISIS for breakfast. But I'm going to be upset. Okay, so you're going
to
be upset. And when you decide...
Right,
but he also has to learn that we can decide what our mood is going to be. A person can decide, I am very upset because I don't have a Ferrari. You know, maybe I should have a Ferrari. It would be so much easier to get around with a Ferrari. And you could really get all hyped up. So maybe it's not about a Ferrari, it's about an iPhone. And maybe it's not about iPhone, maybe it's about continuous internet usage. And maybe it's not about the internet usage, maybe it's because you wish you wouldn't have called the shot that the market was going to go up today or down today or something else and made $1 million. You could find endless things which you could say, gee, I wish it were different. And then be very upset with your lot in life. And it doesn't end. A person can get married and tell himself, gee, maybe I would have been happier had I not married this person. You know, if a person is going to let his mind play that game, I'm not happy because I think it could have been better, which is what the Jewish people were saying here in the desert. God, you gave us good food, you gave us good drink, we're not happy, we want something else on the menu. So then that's a choice a person makes. And a person has to know that. So we live in a generation where we speak as though the world controls us. He made me angry. He made me upset. He's getting on my nerves. He doesn't let me live. Wait a second. Your happiness is contingent on him? You can't control whether you're happy or not? Well, if your happiness is contingent on what you have externally and not on your internal, calm, tranquil state, then you can never be happy. Because today it's the iPhone, tomorrow it's the iPad, the next day it's the Galaxy, and afterwards it's going to be the Ferrari. You'll get there. So today you don't feel bad that you don't have a Ferrari. But when you'll have a Cadillac and you want a Ferrari, then it's going to be very upsetting. No, you shouldn't. No, you shouldn't. You should know. I had a person who I knew, he passed away recently, who was a multimillionaire. He had more money than he could spend. But when I visited him, I was visiting two people, him and someone else, and he asked me where I was going next, and I mentioned who I was meeting next, and he said, "Ooh, you're going to enter that house? Right across from the front door, there's a painting worth $3 million. So I'm thinking, every painting in your house is worth $500,000. So there's $3 million. You have more money than you could spend. What do you care that he has a painting $3 million? That's what, but, yeah.
Such thing?
Yeah.
Sure.
There are paintings in the world worth $3
million? Sure, they're much more than that, sure. Sure. Yeah, just get a painting from Yehuda, right? So, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu tells how he was once going to a person who was purported to be potentially a big philanthropist, and he walks into the room, and he sees the man standing by the window. So, they walk in, and the man is standing there staring. So his assistant asks the man, "What are you staring at?" So he says, "Look." So they look and they ask him, "What?" So he says, "You see my neighbor? He has two brand new Rolls Royces. Those two are brand new." So Mordechai told his assistant, "Let's leave." If he's focused on his neighbor's driveway, then he's not happy with what he has. He can't give anything. A person's happiness, if it's going to be contingent on something external, he'll never get there. And Am Yisrael was saying, "God, we want something else on the menu. We want different bread." What?
How is this different from the time they asked for me?
That deserves a separate discussion. You're right. You're right. Over there, too, you find a similar punishment. They ate and they dropped. But he didn't finish his thought. He's just starting. Our sages tell us, Ezehu Ashir Asamech Bechelko. Who is wealthy? He who is happy with his lot. The essence of a Jew. You ask, what's your essence? Where are you supposed to be? You're supposed to be happy with your lot. What's your lot? Your lot is that God is with you. That God has given us a path which makes sense in life. People spend their life searching. You have a path that makes sense. Well, a person can live this world and consistently have complaints about how God runs the world. And you should know it's part of a whole system. Here, maybe we should go off on a tangent. Should we go off on a tangent?
No. What you just mentioned is emunah.
Right. From the beginning of time, this is a recurring theme in the Torah. Imagine the following case. You have a child, and you tell him, "You could have every cereal we have at home, except for this one. We've bought every cereal they have in the stores, and you could have every single one but one. And that one, in 2 hours, it's going to be Shabbos. In honor of Shabbos, you could have that." Now, what would happen if the kid came to you and say, "You didn't give me anything. It's not worth it. I can't believe it. You're not giving me the cereal I want." You guys know what children are like? You know a child can say that? Let's go back to the Garden of Eden. What happens? God says, "You can eat every tree in the garden, but one. And that one you're going to have tonight. When it's Shabbos, you're going to make kiddush over those grapes. When the Sabbath settles in, you're going to sanctify the day over the wine from those grapes." Along comes the serpent and tells the woman, "Gee, I hear you guys aren't getting anything in this garden. I hear you're not allowed to eat any of the fruits." Perspective. What perspective is he giving the woman? "Yeah, I know they gave you all the other ones, but you know, that's the special one. That one, all the other ones, but that one." Imagine a person has the greatest wealth. He's the wealthiest person in his generation and to a certain degree in all time. And he has a certain people he can't stand. And he gets a decree out that they're all going to get killed. But then he sees one that he can't stand, and he's still alive. He isn't yet dead. So he calls in all his friends and neighbors and says, "I want to tell you how much gold I have." And he starts telling them how many bars of gold, how much silver I have, he tells them that, how many stocks I have, how many ships I have, how many manors I have, how many castles I have. He starts spelling it all out before them. And he says, "You know, all of that is worthless so long as he's walking the face of the planet. We'd say he's crazy. But that's exactly what Haman did. What was Haman doing? Chazal say, Haman, in the story of Esther, was the wealthiest non-Jew that ever lived. So he had over a thousand keys just for the storage houses he had. Every type of wealth you could imagine he had. He hated the Jews, and there was a decree to kill all the Jews. There was one Jew named Mordechai who he happened to bump into on his way home, and he said, all my wealth, everything I have is worthless so long as he's alive. That's the same idea. But you know what? We all live that. We have so many blessings, and yet we think about what we don't have. And then we're very unhappy, and we think we're legitimate in being unhappy because, you know, I want that. Yeah, you could always want that. There will always be things that you could want and not have. And a person's wealth or lack thereof, a person's happiness or lack thereof, stems from within, not from without. Now, this idea was developed into science by Viktor Frankl. You guys heard of the philosopher Viktor Frankl? Yeah? Man's Search for Meaning, right. So Viktor Frankl was in a concentration camp, and the Nazis were tormenting him, and he realized that a person has a choice in every circumstance to define his own existence. There are a lot of external factors, and they can be helpful, but at the end of the day, a person's happiness is his own choice. Well, he was onto a correct idea. That's the idea over here. So, if you want the path to joy and happiness, it begins here. It doesn't begin externally. So when my son wakes up in the morning and says, Abba, I want ices, I don't want to eat breakfast. And I say, no, you're not having ices, you're eating breakfast. And he says, well, I'm not going to be happy if you don't give me ices. I'm going to be very sad. And I say, that's your choice. You want to be sad, you will be sad. That's true. If you decide that without ices you will be sad, then you will be sad, because ices you're not going to get. And the decision to be sad is yours. So, okay, you can be sad. And you know what? It takes usually, I don't know, 2 seconds to 10 seconds for the kid to decide he doesn't want to be sad, and he walks off playing with a smile. Think about it. I speak it from experience. They get ices. They get a lot of ices. But when he tells me, I won't be happy because you didn't give me ices, then I say, fine, if that's the deal, then you won't be happy because you've decided. And I think that's a correct approach that children also have to learn. So,
going back to what you said about being envious of others and not being satisfied with your lot in life, not being satisfied with your lot in life just demonstrates total unstable balance and like zero emunah in a sense. It shows that you're not grateful for all the barakas that Hashem gives you, and it also demonstrates that every day and almost every waking moment of your life, you just dwell on the possessions and the material things of others instead of, you know, thanking Hashem for, you know, even the most insignificant things in life, such as, you know, air or water or food. The people in this world don't get those things.
I'm with you. I just think it's not an all or nothing. Meaning, we all have levels of appreciation, and we all have levels where we have to develop.
But at the same time, when people are so envious of other people and they don't show gratitude to Hashem for what He gives you.
Oh, okay. But I'm just saying, we also have to remember that we're all a work in progress. I called my grandmother one day, and she asked me, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing special." She said, "You said what?" I said, "Nothing special." She said, "I don't want to ever hear that from you again." I said, "What did I say?" She said, "Let me tell you. I was stuck under the floorboards. The Nazis came to our house and they killed a large part of my family. We hid under the floorboards, my brother, my sister, and I. We spent 2 weeks under the floorboards. We could only leave at about 3-4 in the morning, sneak out, get some water, get something to eat, get back under the floorboards. 2 weeks we were under there. We had to do all our bodily needs down there. By the end of the 2 weeks, the stench down there was so unbearable, I prayed to God and I said, God, give me one more opportunity to sit on a rooftop, breathe a normal breath of fresh air, and I will never stop thanking you for the capacity to breathe normally. You're telling me nothing special? That was what my grandmother told me. So I said, Safta, wow, you gave me pshat. That's a Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara says, we say every morning, Kol HaNishamot Tehalel Ko. The verse in Psalm says, every breath will give praise to Hashem. And our sages say, in essence, we should really be thankful for every breath. But we don't live that way, right? So when my grandmother calls and I say, nothing special, she's ready to kill me. But the truth is, she's right. So I learned something. We're all a work in progress. Do I really say thank you for each breath of air? Okay. So yeah, there's a balance.
I think it's very beneficial to show gratitude to Hashem for even the most insignificant things that we don't feel necessary to show gratitude for. Whether it's clean air that we breathe, or water, or food, or things that people in this world don't benefit from. There are people in this world that don't have, you know, hot food to eat all day, or they don't have clean water, or they don't have air, or they don't have a roof over their head. And I think just thanking Hashem even for the bare necessities that sometimes we take for granted. Like I say, for example, coming from New York, from a five-bedroom house in New York to Israel, where I see, you know, Hasidic families that live with 15 people in a two-bedroom apartment, it makes you take everything. You should thank Hashem for everything. Thank you that I have a roof over my head. Thank you that I have Hyundai Get, and I, Mercedes doesn't impress me anymore. You know, it's like when you come to Israel, it's like a total, for lack of a better word, it's like a kick in the ass. I'm sorry for the language.
What about
Colbert?
Well,
Israel has the food.
Uli, what were you saying?
Well, I just wanted to say something about the importance of differentiating between being ungrateful for what you have and having ambition, because that moves the world forward. So it actually turns into a question, which is, when does ambition become greed? Because it's important to want more. It's important to want to improve the world you're living in, to make air conditioning units, you know, to make machines that'll make your life easier. But when does it? At what point can you say, now it just turned unhealthy?
It depends each person on their level. Meaning, what's an Am Haaretz? Am Haaretz, so usually we say, is an unlearned person. But Maimonides says, Am Haaretz is a term of praise. So it's someone who's at least settling the land. He's productive. So on one level, it's better that a person has a job and he's being productive than someone who's a boor. Boor means fallow. It's a piece of land that has nothing. So you have human beings that are fallow. They sit there and they do nothing all day. Zero. You've probably seen people like that. I mean, they might ask you for a donation or a swig of your beer or something else, but they're not too productive. So that's a boor. Am Haaretz, says the Rambam, is a higher level. So okay, that's level number one, someone who's productive. But you understand that there's a pyramid, and every person on their level should aspire to get higher on the pyramid. Meaning, there are people at the top of the pyramid. You'll agree with me that the guy who discovered penicillin was more productive than the guy who's going to install your air conditioner unit. They're each productive, but you want to be more productive, and so on and so forth. So that's really a question that depends on each person. Yes, you could be productive, but the question is, how productive and in what vein and what direction? Yeah, we should be productive. I'm just saying we should try to hone that as well. Okay.